All right. Welcome, guys. Today we have the great pleasure of Craig Kirstens joining us of CitusDB.
Yep.
Craig runs product for Citus on the Citus Cloud hosted database offering and comes with a heck of a lot of experience at Heroku previous to that for many years up through their acquisition by Salesforce. And before that, in a number of software engineer individual contributor roles, is that right?
Yeah, I've had a kind of an interesting background, a mix of a little bit of IC kind of engineering background, actually some sales engineering, some solutions architecture, and then most recently, mostly on the product management side. So I've been an engineer. I don't know if I was ever a really good one, but got some early chops in engineering, then kind of like always been in developer-focused companies. But like that mix of engineering where it kind of business meets it, that kind of fit.
So you're probably the most technical product manager I've met, and that you use and leverage a number of tools to track analytics that I guess the product managers I'm familiar with may not do as rigorously or use the tools as analytically and carefully as you do with your technical background. So for the members of our audience who are product managers who are interested in the ever-long debate of whether they should learn programming or not,
yep.
maybe share with us a few of the tools in your toolkit as a technical product manager.
Yeah, for me, like focusing on like dev or data products, like it's almost a prerequisite that you have some technical background. But even beyond that, I found like being able to dig in to know the technical details, but also dig in and answer my own questions is super valuable. It's no longer kind of just intuition based. It can be data driven, right? For me, I think the number one thing in my toolbox is SQL. And that's one thing that I find even engineers that have been doing it for 20 or 30 years may not be proficient in SQL. And many actually just hate SQL. slightly for some good reason. Like, it's not the prettiest language. It's not the most user-friendly, but it is very powerful. Mm-hmm. And no matter kind of like what product you are, if it's a SaaS-based product and you're the product manager, like, there's data somewhere, and it's probably sitting in a SQL database. Mm-hmm. And if you have to go and ask someone to pull that report, it's just going to be a slower turnaround.
Oh, for sure. Maybe for yourself in your current role, you have a track record of having an engineering background, so getting stakeholders who might manage credentials to the databases to share credentials with
yep.
you so you can run SQL queries isn't so hard. But maybe for some of the younger product managers who may not have, I mean, you yourself don't have a computer science degree, but for a lot of people, it might be hard to get stakeholders to give them SQL access. So maybe for those folks who have a hard time organizationally getting access to writing SQL against the company databases, what do you recommend?
Yeah, so I mean, I think there's a few things in there. One, I think you'd be surprised that like engineers, like when you're willing to self-service and try, like they're usually receptive to that, right? Engineers by nature typically are like learners and want people to self-service. But there's a number of tools such as like getting access to the production data set, the live production database. I myself, who's fairly proficient at SQL, have run queries that have probably brought down Heroku before. It's been a long, long time since that ever happened, but
yeah.
You know, the worst thing is a PM is running a query that I think, hey, I'm just doing some analysis, and then 15 minutes later you have engineers running over your desk saying, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. So there's a number of things that can come in and help with that. So like read replicas of the production data set. Usually it's pretty easy to set this up, and then you have less impact on production. It may be a data warehouse where things are archived on a daily basis. You don't truly need the live up-to-date production data set normally.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite tools actually is, if you're running on Heroku, which many people are, is Dataclips,
yeah.
Which is it's hard to describe, but it's like a live run query in a read-only mode against whatever database.
Mm-hmm.
And you get a unique URL that you can send around. You can actually, we have a number of reports at Citus that live run queries against a Heroku Postgres database return the results in CSV into a Google Sheet, and we chart against it. So it's like a live dashboard against all our production data.
So rather than having to write in SQL all day as a product manager, you can write the SQL once, save that as a kind of report, and then just check a Google Drive spreadsheet on a daily basis to track.
Yeah, exactly. You're investing a few hours up front, and then it's a live update. On a daily basis, I look at what our run rate is, what new customers have signed up, any attrition, changes, upgrades, downgrades, and plans, all this. And it's, you know, SQL backing it, but I wrote it once. And then it kind of refreshes automatically, which is really nice and powerful.
Oh, for sure. I know there's a very active market for third-party services of this kind. There's Chartio, there's Periscope, and there's open source and pretty mature other option called Redash, which we use ourselves. But all of those are options that product managers can use to get their hands dirty early on with SQL.
Yeah, I was actually just meeting with a head of marketing actually at Chartio, I think, 2 days ago.
Oh, nice.
So there's a slew of them out there. I think Chartio is a good one. Periscope, as you mentioned. I think there's, is it Mood or Mode Analytics? One of them.
True.
There's basically a complete suite of options there, and really you can take which one you like and use it. You don't always have to go down to the SQL level. Some of those make it easier to drag and drop. I do encourage product managers really to spend some time and learn SQL.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that gives you a better understanding of the data. So it's not just about self-servicing to me. It's when you understand the underlying data, like you may be able to then ask a question you didn't know you could ask before. And once you understand everything that you have, you're better equipped than just asking the question to an engineer and getting an answer, where you're kind of limiting how far you can go.
I think a lot of folks who may not yet know SQL may get or encounter barriers when they're first learning due to the fact that there's multiple flavors of SQL. You have MySQL, you have Postgres, you have Oracle, God forbid.
Yep.
You have Citus, and the search results that you might find when you search for tutorials on SQL are each slightly different. So maybe for our audience, can you allay people who might be fearful of some of the roadblocks they might encounter in first learning SQL?
Yeah, so I mean, in general, SQL is a standard, and databases usually follow it pretty strictly. Usually. So there are some exceptions there, but you start to get more advanced before you kind of encounter those. Like basic SQL, like querying a table, joining against it, filtering on it, it's going to be the same whether you're on MySQL or Postgres or Oracle or even SQLite. Mm-hmm. So all of the basic building blocks are the same. And then where you're going to get specific is more of what is the database that you're running. Personally, I'm a big fan of Postgres. It's been growing very well. It's open source, so you can not pay as much money to Oracle, which is nice. And then Citus actually is just an extension that sits on top of Postgres. So we're like pure Postgres.
Mm-hmm.
So once you kind of learn Postgres, there's a number of other tools that build on top of it, which make it a nice kind of portable interface.
So I think for people who aren't familiar with Citus, it would be really cool to hear from you, the manager of product at CitusDB, what the product is. What do you guys augment about Postgres?
Yeah, so I guess it would probably make sense to back up a little bit first on what I did at Heroku.
Sure.
So I came over to Heroku. Many people had known about Heroku from the Ruby's world. I actually was not a Rubyist at all. I was more of a Python guy and kind of heard about this thing, but it didn't exist for me at the time. So I came over there as one of their first product managers, and I'm like, okay, this is kind of cool, but I don't do Ruby, but it's a cool company. Along the way, Heroku kept hearing from customers that they needed a place to store data. Like, I'm building this Ruby app, can I save my data somewhere? And Heroku's like, no, just run your app. It turns out, people want a database, right? They need to store state somewhere. So we're like, how hard can that be? Let's just start running Postgres. Turns out there's a lot of work to running a database. In hindsight, it was still a good choice, but there was a lot that went into that. So over time, I ended up running product for Heroku Postgres, where we ran, I think, something like 1.5 million Postgres databases for customers. So like a 1 in a million problem was daily.
Mm-hmm.
But what I saw there, and still a big fan of Heroku Postgres, and still actually run a few databases on it myself, was at a certain level, like the easiest way to scale a database is scale up. So your application, you scale out pretty early. You go from one app server to two, throw a load balancer. It's a reasonably well-defined and solved problem.
Yeah.
Databases, it's the opposite. Like you go up, you go up, you go up, and then suddenly like there's a ceiling here. Like Amazon, for all they do is an infrastructure as a service provider, there's only so big you can go on instances. It's not like you can, you know, say, hey, here's more money, give me a bigger instance. They just don't have it.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw at Heroku was people would scale up, and they're like, well, crap. Now I've got to spend 6 months re-architecting my app. I've got to manually shard. And sharding is essentially where you take data and split it up. So there's a couple of types of apps that lend themselves really, really well to sharding. Really commonly, like a SaaS B2B multi-tenant space. So that's the idea where, like, if you're familiar with Salesforce.com, if you use Salesforce, that data doesn't, your data doesn't interact with anyone else's. Mm-hmm. So like you're a tenant to them, you're a single customer, but it's all isolated. It's never going to interact with someone else's. I can't come in and say, let me see your leads this month for good reason, right?
Probably. Yeah.
So some apps lend themselves very, very well to sharding, where you're splitting this up across multiple physical nodes. So now suddenly you're starting to scale your database the same way you scale your app.
Mm-hmm.
And so long-winded way, saw that problem, had known the Citus guys for a little while, and Citus essentially is an extension to Postgres. So it has, Postgres has all these hooks where you can go and change things on the fly. Transparent to the user, but it hooks in, like, you can add geospatial data types, you can add a key value store, you can do full text search, all these things that you don't think of a relational database doing, it can do because of these extension hooks. Citus hooks in, and to your application, it still looks like a single database. Under the covers, we split it up across multiple physical nodes. Mm-hmm. So it's scaled out horizontally, just like your application, but you don't have to do all that hard work for it.
These are the concept of Postgres extensions.
Right? Yep, yep, exactly.
Sure. These are not so new. They're in version 9 of Postgres?
Yeah,
is that when they were introduced?
They may have been even earlier, but it was right around that time. Like, they've been around for about 7 years now.
There's a lot of extremely interesting new features coming to Postgres, and is one of the reasons I think you guys are well positioned is you've got JSONB handling unstructured data and making Mongo redundant. you have logical replication, which is a tremendously powerful feature, which kind of makes Postgres Firebase-esque in being able to stream new events and updates and creation events and deletion events wherever willy-nilly you want to. A lot of very interesting stuff coming down the pike for Postgres.
Yeah, I think of it more as becoming less of a traditional relational database and more of like a data platform.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you look at all these things being built on it, and it's like, now you don't have to have this high bar for C code that's reviewed by the core committee and released once a year, that an extension can just be built and shipped. There's ones for like hypothetical indexes. Like, what if I added this index? Would it improve performance or not? So a lot of kind of cool things coming based on all that extension framework and APIs without it having to come back into the core. And in addition to all of the core of Postgres, you know, still getting better and better.
So CitusDB, the extension to Postgres, is actually an open source project. Is that correct?
Yep.
And it's viewable on GitHub. If you just Google CitusDB GitHub, you can find the open source project. What's the open source license on the code, if you don't mind me asking?
So it's AGPL, which I think people have opinions on for a lot of software. I think as a database, because we connect via the standard Postgres driver, it still just looks like Postgres, acts like Postgres. And so it's AGPL, take it, run it, use it as you see fit. If you edit it, then you're supposed to contribute that back, basically, is kind of how the license works.
In the very near future, we're going to be covering the topic of different open source licenses like AGPL and what it means to you guys. One of the things I was curious about with Citus is you guys focus on Postgres. Is that merely because you found an attractive market segment, or have you guys considered reproducing what you've done with Postgres for MySQL or Oracle or what have you?
Yeah, so I mean, Postgres was interesting from two perspectives. One, I think it's a rising tide. Like, Hacker News loves Postgres, and you know, who can fault it if Hacker News loves it? But it's actually like gaining more and more momentum over time. It continues to get better. For a while, it was just known as kind of like safe, stable for your database and not the cool thing. Then suddenly you got some of the cool stuff like JSONB, and you know, now it's really rising in momentum. The other thing is that like no other database has that same set of extension APIs to make it as possible. So the fact that we're in extension is very, very key. Most databases, when they start to change things, they fork away. So if you're familiar with like Redshift or Greenplum, they were once upon a time Postgres.
Yeah.
But they were Postgres as of like 6 years ago, as of like 8 years ago. So all these new things like JSONB, like logical replication, they're still waiting on.
Mm-hmm.
And when you fork off of something, it doesn't mean anything on day one. It means something on, you know, year two, year five, year seven. And because of these extension APIs, on, I don't know if it's day one or, you know, week one, but we'll support Postgres 10 and the next version and the next version. So as Postgres gets better, we keep getting better. So it was a fairly key strategic decision that we won't kind of fade away as Postgres continues to improve.
So I guess neither of us are best positioned to talk on this topic of what is MySQL up to, or what is Oracle up to, or what is MS SQL up to, but do any of them have extension APIs that would allow you guys to build or reproduce?
Not in the same way. MySQL has some pluggable backend stuff, but not the same kind of level of hooks.
Mm-hmm.
Oracle, I'm not actually sure at all, but I suspect probably not based on their typical license.
Mm-hmm.
And SQL Server, not in the same way. SQL Server has probably a less ability than MySQL even to be modified. So
yeah.
From what I know, and there may be something I'm missing on both, but from what I know, and I've worked with all of them, it's been a few years, not nearly to the same level, which I think sets Postgres in like often a unique category by itself.
Got it. So one of the common problems dialing back from Postgres and SQL is in product management, getting at data about product usage or product performance, however you measure it. And one of the things that I've seen product managers encounter is when that data is split across multiple different databases. So you might use Postgres for your application database, but you may also use Salesforce for your customer relations management or some other XYZ CRM. For product managers who are in this predicament or pickle, how do you handle that case where, okay, you learned SQL, you know SQL, you can run queries against your app database and get usage information, but what about payments data like churn?
Yep. So the most popular product management statement ever, it depends. It entirely depends on your environment, your setup. But generally, what I try to do is a couple things. So there's within Postgres, there's two options. One, you could look at building a data warehouse where you're ETLing all this stuff and basically saying, hey, let's do a nightly sync from Salesforce into my Postgres database and from Stripe into my Postgres database and from here. And that I found generally works okay. You can do this with some lightweight Python scripts, which is my favorite thing to do. Just schedule it on a cron job or Heroku scheduler to run once a day, and it's brute force. It's probably not the most elegant thing, but it just works, which mm-hmm. as a product manager works really well. You can do a, you know, more complicated ETL pipeline if you need to. I usually find that works. The other option is Postgres actually has a really cool feature called foreign data wrappers, where you can connect from inside Postgres to another data source. So I could connect from inside Postgres to Redis and actually query and join these things in a very cool way.
So even though Redis does not have a direct SQL interface, you can use SQL to query Redis?
Yep. Even like SQL to query Mongo. There is a Mongo foreign data wrapper that you can query directly into Mongo using SQL from inside Postgres.
So foreign data wrappers are a relatively new addition to Postgres that allows you to use a Postgres instance to drive these queries that are ran against these foreign data sources.
Yep.
Is it realistic to depend on foreign data wrappers to do things like we're describing, or is it immature relative to some other options that people might consider?
I think they're fairly stable. Coming back, it depends, right?
Yeah.
So I wouldn't put it into a production app, but if you're doing like offline product management, like data analysis, it's something I've actually regularly used. Mm. And you know, I guess production for me from a reporting standpoint perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking to put it like live to users, there's some extra latency there. There's probably better ways to design and build things.
Do you mind sharing what specific foreign data wrappers you've used to do this type of stuff?
So my favorite one actually is the Postgres foreign data wrapper.
Okay.
So if I've got two different, completely different Postgres systems, it just makes sense, right? And that's very common, as I've seen. I think at Heroku, we had something like a total of, you know, 30, 40 probably different Postgres databases in total that some house stuff about the dashboard, some had stuff about billing, some about the core database. And this was actually the easiest way to say, here, set up this other Postgres table within this database and just as a logical mapping. And it's live going to push down that query. I've played with, at times, the Redis one. I've never used the Mongo one because I've never run Mongo in production. Those are the big two. I've actually played with the Salesforce one before.
Have you successfully set it up and were able to query, for example, the leads table or the contacts tables from your Salesforce instance?
Yeah, I've definitely been able to do that from a proof of concept. For me, and I've written this three times now, I just write a sync process that runs nightly and pulls over stuff via the bulk API.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a little faster and not kind of hitting the REST API of Salesforce. But yeah, so I was able...
Sounds a lot like logical replication.
It's not quite as... It's a little more brute force, but it's the same idea. Yeah, like basically just pull things over. And I find on a lot of product management things, like brute forcing... doesn't have to be the best engineering that it gets the job done. And I actually find the engineers kind of appreciate that, of like, you don't have to over-engineer. If it gets the job done, that's perfect.
For sure. There's a couple of open source projects for people who are down with over-engineering that I want to plug real quick that I have not personally contributed to yet. One is called Bottled Water.
It's an interesting one. There's some mixed opinions on it.
For sure.
Whether it's production ready.
I don't believe they advertise it as being production ready, nor is it actively developed at this point.
Yep.
I think last active development was a year plus ago by the folks at Confluent who managed the Kafka project.
They actually took it over. The primary development was, I believe, by Sam Stokes and Martin Kleppman.
Okay.
So two
the
guys
reportive
out of Reportive. Yeah, exactly. So they did a lot of development on it. We actually funded some of it at Heroku.
Oh, interesting.
For a little while for Sam to do some things. And it's very cool. I guess we should actually explain what it does.
Yeah, absolutely. What is bottled water?
So bottled water actually is streaming change data capture. So everything that happens from inside Postgres into Kafka.
So creating a row, inserting a row, updating a row,
deleting
rows.
All this. So basically you've got an audit trail from everything you do in your Postgres database going into Kafka. And then you can do whatever you want, right? You can like set your topics, you can consume it, you can alert on it, you can filter, you can send it to other places. But the idea is, like, if Kafka is kind of your streaming hub where you're going to send data out to different places, Postgres is your system of record. Let's get all that system of record, everything that happens, into Kafka and do what you want. So it's very cool. It parses the Postgres write-ahead log, figures out what to do.
So the common variation that possibly all of our engineering audience might be familiar with is in your web app, you have some post API endpoint where somebody creates a new resource, you perform an insert into a SQL database or a non-SQL database, and then you do a subsequent second write to a different database. For example, a full text search database like Elasticsearch. So you're ending up in your app server doing two things. One is writing to SQL, one is writing to Elasticsearch.
And you hope one doesn't fail and you have to unwind and...
So the brilliance of this Kafka solution where you listen to the Postgres logs and write it to a log, another log that can be read from, is that you can fan out your writes or any of your write operations to any listener that you want to set up in the future. And not only that, but that log can be replayed from the very beginning of your database. So not only can you be assured that You have all events as of the moment you switch on your new listening service, but you can replay everything from the beginning of the state of your database, which has some tremendously beneficial properties.
Yeah, we leverage that same kind of capabilities of the write-ahead log in Postgres for like point-in-time recovery for Citus. So it was actually yesterday at 5 p.m. we had a customer that said, oh crap, I just ran a migration, my test migration, which drops all the tables against production.
This is not uncommon.
It happens way more than you think. So if you've ever done it, one, feel a little bad. But two, you're not the only person. It's I don't know if it's I hear about it once a week, but I hear about it a reasonable amount. I also hear, you know, it from a customer whose customer deleted data. But with the write-ahead log, you can say, give me the backup and replay the log up to this second or minute in time. Mm-hmm. So we actually, you know, recovered their database in several terabytes within 50 minutes to the 1 minute before that ran.
Nice.
So it was, I was actually out to dinner following along, checking as the, you know, we were taking care of it, ran a couple of commands, and I checked in an hour and a half when I was kind of back at home from dinner. We're like, everything's good, thanks. I kind of saved the day, so.
I mean, I think this happens more often than you hear about it, probably. You probably hear about one in every five times that this happens.
Usually customers, when they delete their data, they usually say, can you help me? I know you probably can't. So it's nice to be like, actually, we completely got you covered. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could imagine that customers probably do it on their own too and just say, well, I'm going to go to the backup that's 2 days old.
So coming to Citus, you had this wealth of experience with managing Postgres databases, over a million of them at Heroku. The backup system, is it any different? I know at Heroku you have these snapshots using Wally.
Yep.
For members of our audience that might not know what Wally is, do you mind sharing what Wally is?
Yeah, so Wally's a Python tool that basically, so Postgres, as we've kind of talked about, under the covers, it's one giant append-only log. That's known as the write-ahead log. And basically, when you write a record, it's written to that. When you update a record, it's written to that. When you delete a record, it's actually a write to that log. And what we do is take, we leverage Wally. We actually have the engineer that wrote it at Heroku. And we actually released a new version of it a week ago, WallG, rewritten in Go, which is something like between 4 and 7x faster on the ability to restore a database. But what we do is take a base backup, which is like the logical bytes on disk, and then the write-ahead log and archive that to S3.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that means if your entire database fails, we can recover from it. And that's kind of one type of backup within Postgres. So that's what's known as a physical backup. More people probably know about when you run a PG dump, right? When you download this archive locally to restore to staging or that sort of thing. That's actually like the raw SQL inserts. So it's more machine portable, but when you actually run PG dump, it introduces a lot of load to your database. So most high volume databases don't run PG dump. So we have a very similar setup where, like, if you want to, you can run PG dump. But for Citus, we basically, when I came over to Citus, engineer number one and two from Heroku Postgres team also joined Citus. So it's a very similar experience. As one of them jokes, doing the exact same thing the second time around is a lot faster and easier. And you don't have to make the same mistakes.
I'm realizing that we've gotten pretty technical in talking about specific Postgres features and specific projects. I forgot to mention the second open source project that I really quickly wanted to plug, which is called Maxwell. And it is a rendition of what Bottled Water does, as we were just describing, but for MySQL. And it listens to the MySQL write-ahead log, which I'm not sure if it's called the write-ahead log, and distributes that to Kafka.
Gotcha.
Designate, and performs the exact same way and is production ready and is used by a number of companies that we all might have heard of that I'm blanking on at the moment.
I would guess Uber is one, but I'm not sure.
So Uber, really good story there that maybe our product management audience might not care too much about, but our Postgres and database aware folks might, is how Uber, very high profile user of Postgres, made the decision to switch from Postgres to MySQL. And I think you had some commentary about that situation, or you obviously paid attention to that conversation as it happened in the public. Do you think they made the right choice? Are the flaws that Postgres encountered things that they should have been able to surmount?
I think they definitely could have lived with Postgres. I think it's actually really funny. If you look back in time, they wrote like the exact opposite article 2 years before, how they migrated from MySQL to Postgres, mm-hmm. And how MySQL, like there's an almost identical article from 2 years prior. I mean, the short of it, I think, is they couldn't find Postgres people to hire. They had experience. They actually had some new management that had come in with a MySQL background. They knew how to run it. And really, if you read through, what they did was build a whole other NoSQL engine on top of a relational database. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they should be using MySQL or Postgres at all, mm-hmm. versus like something much lower level, mm-hmm. Based on what they're doing. So, and
well, this brings up an extremely relevant point for members of our audience who might be earlier in their careers or still debating what skills to learn, is if there isn't a market supply for people familiar with the technology, maybe it's not the right technology to use. And that manifests in different ways. But for our audience we've highly recommended learning SQL, I think we should restate that learning SQL is a pretty universal skill.
Yeah, it's not going anywhere. It's I think it's been around for, 30 years. It is, it is the lingua franca of data. Mm-hmm. It's outlived a whole bunch of things that were supposedly going to replace relational databases, and even on all the NoSQL databases now they have a SQL layer on top. You look at
MongoDB,
Cassandra, Spark, all these things that are the cool new things necessarily. They also just have a SQL like interface. Mm-hmm. So you're not missing out on much.
Oh, for sure. I think I was reading about how Mongo, who the parent company TenGen is filing for IPO recently, or has filed for IPO recently, when they announced that they had a replication system in place for ETL and analytics, turns out it was actually Postgres foreign data wrapper.
Yeah. So
using SQL.
SQL is a fairly safe, like, you don't have to worry about, like, you learn something that you're not going to be able to use.
So dialing back from SQL, dialing back from these open source projects, what might be specific about working on product management for developer-focused products like Citus Cloud?
Yeah, basically developers are horrible customers, so don't, I wouldn't encourage anyone to go down that path.
Well, why are they horrible customers?
So, developers usually have really strong opinions. They're often actually a little cheap. Developers, it's interesting. For developers trying to automate so many things, sometimes they won't always do the cost analysis of, like, if I automate this myself, it took me how many hours versus what do I bill at per hour? I've seen more and more discussions about this, how developers are starting to do the economics and say, it's totally worth it for me to pay $500 for this service. Yes, I could automate it in 10 hours, but okay, I can go and bill for 10 hours, which pays off much better. I do find it very rewarding. Like, it's a challenge. You've got to actually add a lot of value, and developers by nature are already technical, so they can do a lot of these things. So there's a bit of a higher bar, I would say. You can't go and, like, do something very, very simple. You actually do have to go solve typically a hard problem, which to me is really rewarding, also very challenging. So I think it's a very interesting approach to product management, and a bit of a different one from a lot of other kind of product managers kind of out there in other industries. Like, if you're a product manager at, I don't know, Uber or Facebook, like, it may be still good to be technical, but how people interact with pictures, or how most of people new to Uber on board, is a very, very different problem than selling to engineers.
I think one of the other particulars about product management, maybe for Citus, which offers hosted database service offerings, is the concept of lock-in that a lot of customers have to grapple with. And might be one other big dimension to how engineers as customers think, or developers as customers think. And once they're on a platform like an Oracle, they're on Oracle for a long while yet, and there's a high switching cost. So have you ever worked on products that don't have high switching costs and do not require selling to somebody who has this fear of lock-in?
I'm trying to think a little bit there. I mean, maybe Heroku, like in terms of high switching costs, like there are some lock-in there. Like if you're using Heroku Postgres, if you're using Heroku, like yes, your data lives in there, but you can take and run Postgres yourself. It's open source. Mm-hmm. Citus is actually somewhere in the middle there, I think, in that, if you use our database as a service, give us your data, it's there. But we're also, as you mentioned earlier, like open source. Take it running yourself. You don't actually have to pay us anything, and you could run and use the database. Mm-hmm. Which keeps that bar high. We have to keep providing value, delivering a good service, because as soon as we don't do that, then why would you stay? Mm-hmm. In terms of like...
Well, I guess how do you, in trying to sell Citus as a hosted offering, allay fears of lock-in?
Yeah, I think a big part of it is just that open source piece, right? Like, we are Postgres. It is open source. Take it running yourself. And a lot of people will show up and say, hey, I just want to learn a little more on the open source. I don't know if I trust you kind of running my database yet. And then having some conversations with them, they understand the experience that comes with a team, the additional value that comes with it. So you usually start on that side of, I don't want to be locked in. And then later say, you know what, there's enough value in this. It absolutely makes sense. And then there's that open source piece. And I think as you find a lot of developer products, database products, there is an open source angle to it that allays that fear.
I think there's a significant fraction of our audience that may not even know exactly what open source might even refer to. So one of the things that for our audience members who don't know or have never contributed themselves or even understand the concept of contributing, are there any good first projects or groups that people can go to and meet up in person with people who can coach them on what is open source, B, walking them through their first contribution to open source, even if it's just adding documentation?
Yep. Yeah, so that's a great question. So, I mean, like, open source is the idea that, like, code is completely open, free, public, take it, use it. And it sounds like you'll get into the licensing part in the future, which is a whole other world. There's a number of places. So at a lot of conferences, so like a DjangoCon or PyCon or a RailsConf or RubyConf, a lot of them will end up doing sprints afterwards. And a sprint is where, like, after the conference, so conference, you know, you go to a bunch of talks, learn something, hopefully, maybe not, meet a bunch of other developers. But afterwards, there's usually a day or two where there's, like, pizza, coffee, beer, and people just hacking on these open source projects. And people will say, hey, usually there's some big name projects there, like a Django or Rails. We're working on this project. 10 of us will meet at this table. And you sit there and code. And I find that's actually a great opportunity to come and... All open source projects usually track bugs in public. And a lot of bugs are really easy ones of, like, this isn't documented well, which is a great place to start. Usually it seems like a pretty, like, scary thing to dig into and start at first. I do find, like, the Django and Rails communities and Ruby community and Python in particular, and I actually probably some of the Node community as well, I don't know it quite as well, mm-hmm. are very welcoming. And I think there's some blog posts, if you look on those main projects, here's how to do your first contribution to open source. And here are, like, good things to tackle as a first-time contributor.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for people who are feeling overwhelmed, attending a conference like Craig just described is super helpful. You'll meet a lot of very friendly people who are very invested in their projects and are happy to have your help and educate you on how to contribute effectively. So all of the advice Craig is giving here is gold.
Yeah. And there's probably, like, a local group near you. Like, there's Rails girls, women who code. There's some, I think, a couple of Django ones. So there's usually a bunch of like regional, and it didn't have to be one of these big national conferences. I think there's a bunch of regional ones. There's like, I'm trying to think of where all the Ruby ones. There's Py Tennessee, which is in Tennessee. There's Py Ohio. There's one in Tennessee, a Python one in Orlando.
And of course, there's meetup.com. There's plenty of technical meetups on whatever programming language you're getting started with or are using in your work. And oftentimes, those will have events that may not be focused on open source sprints and contributing to code live and in person with other people, but they're a great kicking off point for meeting people who can help you through your first open source contributions.
And there's probably someone there that's done it before that can help. And like asking the question is probably the hardest part. And then you may get more help than you wanted. You may have three people willing to help you right there. because I mean, generally like people care about the community, what they're doing, and happy to help grow it.
For sure. Well, this has been freaking awesome. Thank you for joining us, Craig.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm sure we'll talk again with you very soon.
Thanks.